Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Value Inspiration Podcast. My name is Ton Dobber and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration. The purpose of my company is to help business software companies rethink what can be to become remarkable again. The goal that I have in this podcast is to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. So my strong belief is that we can think big, and therefore we should. And doing so will help to create a better world for all of us. And this podcast is all about that. My guest on the podcast today is Mauricio Vecchione, Executive Vice President for Global Good and Research at Intellectual Ventures.
I mean, we see the world as having a technology gap. No one has a monopoly on innovation. So the idea that all next-gen things happen in places like Silicon Valley, I think is fundamentally flawed. We are using the word catalytic invention to indicate disruptive new technologies that are more than just a new technology, that they truly have the ability to catalyze a sea change in a problem. The needs of the developing world are so stringent, they're so difficult, that if you choose to address them, you're actually catalyzing a change in disruptive behavior that allows an improvement, not just for the developing world, but across the board.
This is Mauricio, and working in his day-to-day job for Intellectual Ventures, he's overseeing Global Good LLC, an evergreen fund created by Bill Gates and Intellectual Ventures. The fund is focused on inventions and innovations for the millions of people in the developing world that suffer and die each year from causes that humanity has the scientific and technical ability to solve. During this interview, you'll learn three things. Firstly, why Mauricio believes that the idea that all next-generation things happen in places like Silicon Valley is fundamentally flawed. Secondly, how catalytic invention can be the approach to accelerate change, action, and impact, not just for the developing world, but actually across the board. And thirdly, three practical criteria to embrace in the process of innovation. Mauricio, thank you very much for joining. First question to you is a simple one. Can you introduce yourself?
Absolutely, Ton. So I'm Mauricio Vecchione. I am the Executive Vice President for Global Good and Research at Intellectual Ventures. And the Global Good Fund, which I manage at Intellectual Venture, is a collaboration between Intellectual Ventures and Bill Gates, whose purpose is to develop technologies for humanitarian goals. So we have a nonprofit goal, if you want to think of it that way, where we're really trying to leverage the sum total of science, technology, and innovation for the benefit, really, of the 3 billion people that live in the roughly 75 to 100 countries that make up the base of the pyramid. And we have some specific strategies on the business side as well as on the technology side, which I think paint sort of a new picture for how to do that.
Cool. Yes, I've heard about the fact that you gave a keynote recently at SIM, and it had the title Invention Saving Lives. You made a couple of interesting points about the science and technology that really have transformed our lives, where we actually didn't really need our lives to be changed. That's an interesting point. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, we see the world as having a technology gap. And let me first of all suggest that the world has sort of been trained to think about technology as one class of technology, which is typically, you know, associated with mobile phones and apps and those kind of things. And those are incredible things that fundamentally the internet has unleashed. But technology is a much wider space. And just think about all of the science and the developments of the last couple of decades in genomics, in big data, in biotechnology. And so we take a very holistic approach to thinking about science and technology. And when you do that, you discover that close to half of the population of the planet really fundamentally lives their lives without access to all those modern things that that we just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And when I said that technology hasn't, that we didn't need technology innovation to survive, what I really meant is, you know, as incredible as things like the internet have been, and by the way, you know, I've been an entrepreneur in high technology for many years of my life and have benefited both as a businessman, as an entrepreneur from all those technologies, as transformative as having the internet or mobile phones has been to our personal lifestyles, our very survival didn't depend on it.
Sure.
We didn't start out by saying, if I don't have a mobile phone, I'm going to die. And the reality in the parts of the world that we're talking about is that you got people whose very survival are dependent on the lack of access or the access to modern science.
Yes, I agree. Could you give an example of that?
Think just of what's happening in medicine. The access to modern technologies, whether it be new drugs, whether it be drugs that are focused on the diseases that are affecting the majority of the people on the planet that are not in the first world, all the way to simple access to things like precision agriculture that can transform the life of a smallholder farmer in Africa. All those factors are really a matter of survival before they even become a matter of economic activity. And we think that's a huge inequity. And so that was really a lot of what I was trying to say with that message, is that there is sort of an important agenda for science and technology in providing access that has the ability not only to transform lives, but has the ability to save lives.
Yeah, right. I agree with that. It has a completely different meaning for those people that are really in a need there. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, so first of all, we have to get away from what I would describe as parachute technology or parachute science. You know, the model that we in the West or in the first world somehow have all the answers and we can do all this great research and we can go over to the poor people in Africa or other places and sort of parachute in some new technologies and magically transform their lives. That's sort of a bad model. But unfortunately, it's amazing how much global development and global health still works that way.
Why do you believe that's a bad model?
Well, it's a bad model because generally it doesn't understand the problem. The second reason, and this was perhaps the more important point of my speech, is no one has a monopoly on innovation. So the idea that all next gen things happen in places like Silicon Valley, I think is fundamentally flawed. Because what Silicon Valley is, it's an ecosystem that feeds on itself. And so it has had success. So therefore it has resources available to bring more success. But more importantly, it feeds on a set of problems that those operating in that ecosystem are familiar with and recognize. And what's happening is those are problems that are generally not the problems of the 3 billion people living in the developing world. So while occasionally you will get to things like cell phones, which started out as a sort of toys for the rich and made its way to everyone because they got cheaper and then they became something that now people in the developing world use almost with more utilization that people in the first world, because they sort of leapfrog. But setting aside mobile phones, the vast majority of problem sets that technology could address, or science and technology could address, are really pretty specialized to the setting that they're in. Take the subject of disease as an example. If I had to ask you, what kills most people on the planet? If you are a typical first world resident, you would probably answer with questions like, with diseases like cancer and cardiovascular disease and so on. And actually, some of those diseases don't make the top 10 when it comes to the majority of the people on the in the world that live in low resources.
Yeah, true. So what does it mean? Isn't this addressed equally?
True. Now, I hesitate saying that one disease is more important than another. And there is certainly an argument to be made about the fact that there is evolution in the burden of disease, and that over time, all of the world will look the same. But for now, there is a huge inequity, because if you take the sum total investment in science and technology for disease, for medical science, according to one survey from Booz Allen, it was roughly $600 billion of R&D investment a year. Yeah. And you ask the question, how much of that $600 billion is actually spent for the diseases that are affecting the 3 billion people in low resources that are essentially dealing with extreme poverty as a factor? And the answer is a staggering only roughly 3 billion. Wow. So the vast majority of today's R&D is being spent on the diseases that are important in the first world, but not in the rest of the world. And actually, ironically, the majority of the people on the planet don't have their needs addressed by that investment. Now, we think that as a huge inequity. We think of that as a huge gap. And it's a long-winded way of saying that all the money spent in cancer research is not likely to cure malaria. And that's why, when you get beyond cell phones, it is not as simple as inventing technologies that then progressively get cheap and eventually become ubiquitous. Unfortunately, in areas like medicine, you've got to target the problem specifically. And it all centers on understanding the problems. And the other part of this discussion is the fact that the developing world is extremely innovative. And so if you were to provide the tools to those scientists that may be in Africa or maybe in Asia, maybe in these parts of the world, they have the ability to understand the problems that is affecting their region. And they have also the problem to innovate, including innovate in disruptive ways. And just think about what's happening in China, which was a developing world country not too long ago, or what's happening in India right now in terms of the ability of those countries to muster very significant science and technology resources and innovate. And I don't think the time is too distant when sort of a globalized innovation will drive new research priorities across the world, and often using the developing world as a launch point to what will become global disruptive new technologies. And I have some examples to give you, but maybe I'll pause for a second and see if you have a question.
Actually, you made the point pretty clear to me. But I want to connect what you just talked about to another key element from your keynote, which, from what I understood, could be the solution to this, but possibly many other problems around the world. You coined the phrase catalytic invention. Can you elaborate a bit further on this?
Yeah, so, you know, that speaks to a different subject, which is, if you talk to global development folks, people who have been doing this kind of work for some time, they will tell you that a lot of problems in the world exist, but are not necessarily technology problems. So So the global development industry has had a skepticism whether, you know, everything can be actually solved with technology. And of course, I would never argue that every problem is a technology problem. No. But there's clearly, some people have called me irrationally exuberant about this, that there is clearly a lot of things that the right technology intervention, and again, I'm using the word technology to be very broad, so it includes science and undiscovered science, could really transform people. Again, going back to the example in medicine, think about the impact of a new vaccine, or think about the impact of a new type of diagnostics, or even just the delivery of healthcare in alternative business models, or the convergence between things like artificial intelligence, big data, to use popular words, and medical devices. So we are using the word catalytic invention to indicate disruptive new technologies that are more than just a new technology, that they truly have the ability to catalyze a sea change in a problem, that they are catalytic because they can catalyze a completely different approach to solving a problem, and that fundamentally find the roots in the science and the technology. And I think when you look at something like a new vaccine, that's an example of it, because a new vaccine means you can prevent a disease, and all you need to do is make sure that enough people have access to it, and you can now get into a position where you can not only prevent a disease, but essentially create an immunity in the immunological field, they call it a herd immunity, that prevents the disease from spreading, and ultimately, if you do it widely enough, can completely eradicate the disease. That's something, by the way, that with the Gates ecosystem has been a priority. We have a series of diseases that are actually targeted for eradication, and we're very close with the polio disease. And again, vaccines is not the only tool, but it's a tool to accomplish that, and it has transformative power to that society. Just ask the hundreds of thousands of kids that were paralyzed, you know, not too long ago, even in the first world, from a disease that now is down to just a few hundred cases in the world. Wow. So that's what we mean for catalytic invention. And catalytic invention, increasingly, you know, it used to be that people talked about some massive proverbial moonshots as the way you arrive to some of these transformative inventions. For the longest time, people talked about the space program that way. They said, you know, the space program, in addition to getting us to play the moon, it's driving a huge amount of innovation that is catalyzing lots of change in lots of other areas. Well, I would almost like to challenge everybody that the needs of the developing world are so stringent, they're so difficult, that if you choose to address them, you're actually catalyzing a change in disruptive behavior that allows an improvement, not just for the developing world, but across the board.
Interesting. Can you give an example?
Think about the reason why Europe, for example, even though mobile telephony was invented in the States and was first deployed in the States, Europe rapidly adopted it and leapfrogged the U.S., because they didn't have existing wireline infrastructure that could be relied to do things like data services. And so they adopted it as a leapfrog mechanism. When I see healthcare delivery, for example, next generation medicine, and I see the needs in the developing world where it's not just about price or affordability, but it's really about accessibility. It's really about the fact that you don't have enough doctors to give you access to specialists. And so you need somehow a technology that can take a mediocre clinician and turn it into the best clinicians in the world. Those are disruptive things that could frankly work everywhere, not just in the developing world. And I do think that the developing world has the opportunity to use catalytic invention to leapfrog And I think the companies that embrace that concept are likely to not only do well in the developing world as the developing world becomes an emerging market, but they're likely to be able to leapfrog and ride a wave of disruption everywhere. And so part of my argument around catalytic invention is that companies should think about the needs of the developing world, not as charity, not as social responsibility, but they should think about it as a strategic business plan to address disruption and ultimately leapfrog technologies everywhere, not just in the developing world, using the requirements of the developing world as the target.
Yes, because these requirements are much harder and much tougher to beat than we typically used to hear.
Exactly. And typically they'll result in a better quality service or product at a lower price. And yeah. Who doesn't want that?
Agree. So what do you think needs to change in order to achieve something like this?
Well, I think it's a gradual change. I don't think it's overnight. I think some of the macroeconomic trends in these countries are also helping because increasingly these countries have high growth associated with them. So they're becoming real markets. I started in business not too long ago. I don't consider myself that old, but I can tell you when I started in business, China was just beginning to open up. And I remember a business thought leader at the time telling me to don't waste time with China, that they'll never become a real market, that they'll never do anything besides cheap goods, et cetera, et cetera. And today, especially in technology, you would never build a business plan that doesn't factor China in. And I think we're going to see similar trends. It's not an accident that out of the top 10 fastest growing economy, most of them are in the developing world and quite a few are in Africa. So granted, it's a long way to go before those are viable economies. There are congenital issues, whether it's corruption or political strife or whatever that stand in the way. But really fundamentally, there are very vibrant new economies that are emerging. I think countries like China understand that. That's why they're doing massive investments in places like Africa. Yeah. And I, it's brought Bill Gates to predicting that chronic poverty, extreme poverty may be eradicated from the world in the next couple of decades. So if you want to take that optimistic view, then the 3 billion people that today live in the developing world should be thought of as tomorrow's 3 billion new customers. And companies that have the ability to think that way can build the kind of business plans that can then drive disruption and do all the things that we talked about it. Now, we're not there. Very few companies have the ability to think strategically over the long term. But I am seeing signs of very enlightened companies that not coincidentally are generally speaking overperforming, where they're starting to think seriously about what does the world look like in 10 or 15 years and what are the emerging markets that they really need to build a brand today in. And for those companies, then we think philanthropy at scale of the type that we do at Global Good and within the Gates ecosystem is a good partner. Because we can help those companies bridge what would be otherwise the period of investment, especially around new products and technologies. And we can do it with philanthropic dollars that essentially don't require an ROI, at least an ROI in financial terms. We measure our ROI in, lives saved or outcomes. And I think that's at a time when there are major philanthropic efforts beginning to operate at scale around innovation, and it's not just the Gates investments. I think there is a way to create a sort of grand bargain between philanthropic mission and corporate missions that to some extent can drive some of this outside of the normal donor environment of the government. Now, government help is always fundamental, And in any way, I'm not advocating that we shouldn't have commitment on the part of, you know, foreign aid and countries. But I think there is an ability to supplement that, especially in the area of innovation, by really creating global business plans with companies that can also tap in a kind of sort of free R&D that we can do with and for them to really drive some of this mission forward. And I think that's what we've been focused on at Global Good. And frankly, we're starting to see some signs of success. Now, of course, it's very early in this process.
Well, that's very good news. Question, how long do you think it will take in order to reach a high point?
Well, I think, you know, most people in global development think about a series of key goals that are in the 20 to 25 year time frame. Now, I tend to be a technologist, so I tend to be impatient. So to me, that's too long. But realistically, I see progress and progression happening every year between now and, say, 25 years from now. Yeah. And I think the net outcome will be that these countries will evolve out of being, the extreme poverty environments. And you're going to have lots of abilities to leapfrog in various areas that could possibly become global trends. And, you know, one example is what I wanted to share is what's happening in mobile payment systems. Yeah. So if you think about mobile payment system, we tend to think about things like Apple Pay as the key enabling technology. But actually, if I had to ask you which country has the highest utilization of mobile payment system, you'd probably be very surprised if when I tell you that it's Kenya.
Exactly. It's one of the countries in the middle of Africa.
Exactly. And some of there's something called the Silicon Savannah going on right now in Nairobi, which stem from the success of global companies in things like mobile payment that emerged out of Africa because they didn't have a banking system that they could rely. And so they had to figure out a different way to access banking services and other factors. And the result was global companies have emerged from there. To me, those are signs that this vision is actually accelerating. And I wouldn't be surprised. No, very few people predicted what happened in China as quickly as it happened. I don't want to say Africa will be the next China, but there are other factors at work. But it certainly has the ability to join, to move very rapidly. And I think technology can inherently accelerate that. So I'm very optimistic about some of the changes you'll see in healthcare and healthcare delivery, for example. I don't think it'll take 25 years to affect the change, at least not in the major countries from a population perspective in the developing world.
Well, that would be fantastic if that would happen. To close the conversation off, you've been very inspiring in terms of what you had to say. But I have one question which is related to some advice that I would like to get from you. What would be the top three things that people listening to this podcast could do and start doing different tomorrow?
Well, so I think the first thing to do is to understand the problems you're trying to tackle. Whether that's building a business plan for the developing world or whether it's targeting a specific market segment, it's very difficult to do that to understand these markets without a lot of sort of bottom-up understanding, because it's not as simple as hiring a market research firm and getting a market report. Yeah. I think there is something that I call the three A's in developing these business plan and ultimately thinking about products to do this kind of work. I think you need to meet all three of the A's in order to be effective. And most people think that it's only about the first A, which is what I call affordability. Affordability is certainly important, and making things accessible at a lower cost is a key strategy. But it's useless without the other two A's, which help you define the problem and then ultimately the solution. The second A is what I call appropriateness. So, I can show you fantastic next generation medical imaging systems in African hospitals that are sitting there with a blanket over them because there are no doctors to use them or there's no power to power them. That whomever designed that product didn't think about the appropriateness of the technology they were developing. Okay. So you need to understand the context and therefore the appropriateness. And it's not just human-centered design. It's a lot more. It's the logistics. It's the ecosystem that the device has to go. It's how people will use it. So all those factors go into that second A. And the third A is what I call accessible. At the end of the line, if you need to transport a piece of equipment to a location for it to be effective, and there are no roads to get there, that's a question of accessibility. How do you make it accessible to the population, to the customers, to the users that ultimately will translate into an impact? So I think the projects that scale up and that are indeed good business models meet all three of those A's. And people have used other language to describe the same concepts, but it's very important that companies that are serious about this focus on those three A's. And the second thing is really the question about thinking about the developing world not as a charitable or social responsibility project, but thinking of it as a market. And therefore doing the kind of things that ultimately result into profitable business models. And maybe the time horizon needs to be a little longer than you would in a normal product introduction in the first world. But, there is no more sustainable innovation than an intervention created by a company who becomes self-sustaining because it's profitable around a product that then can scale up accordingly. And we're big believers of that. And we don't think making money and doing good are mutually exclusive.
And I completely concur with that. Thank you. This was really, really inspiring. Any final comment or ask you want to make?
No, thank you for your vision and your good work in trying to promote these messages. And I would urge any of your listeners that are practically speaking, trying to implement this kind of program, do think of folks like us at Global Good as partners. Because, as I say, we're tapping into charitable funding to essentially help start these projects that may be difficult to rationalize to shareholders in classic sort of ROI terms. And so we can provide some help.
And I'm sure that people listening to this podcast will certainly get in touch with you, Maurizio. The goal of this podcast is to share compelling ideas and showcases to inspire what can be when technology and people blend in the right way. It's my strong belief that too much focus is put on automating people out of a process, in other words, cutting costs, rather than scenarios where the unique strength of people are augmented with technology to change the established rules and to deliver value that was unimaginable before. So, with this podcast, I want to make a contribution to change this, to create a broader awareness of what can be, to accelerate the adoption by bringing together you, a tribe of like-minded people and organizations. And lastly, to accelerate the initiatives and solutions that could be created because one idea inspires the other. So if you know about stories that are worth sharing, please send me a message. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. If you want to have more information, read my blogs, or obtain information on working with me, just visit me on my website, valueinspiration.com. Thank you for tuning in, and you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast or provide me with your feedback. I'll see you shortly in a new episode.